Most people only think of the Egyptians at the mention of ancient African people, but there were so many more civilizations. Eastern Africa is where the human species has its roots, and the area has been inhabited by us and our ancestors for millions of years. Can you believe that an African kingdom adopted Christianity before the Eastern Roman Empire? And best of all, how do King Solomon and the Ark of the Covenant fit in here? I'm Laura Taylor, and with me, as always, my pop culture expert, Andrew Hook.
Hello there.
Welcome to Digging Deeper with the Ancients. Before we get into this episode, I want to mention that this is another one of those topics where there is a lot of conflicting information out there. Many sources have different dates as to when this kingdom began, when it reached its height, and even when it adopted Christianity. The problem is that there isn't much information to go off of, so a lot of scholars are making educated guesses. One more note, for the purposes of this civilization, I will use the words civilization, kingdom, and empire interchangeably. Because unlike ancient Rome, which had major government changes approximately every 500 years, there isn't a lot known about these people, and so they're all just, it's all just one civilization.
Not enough wells are being dug.
But the other thing is, we've done this before. Both the Olmec and the Angkor people, there was really only the one time period that you can't really break it apart at all. Mm. East Africa was the cradle of our species for millions of years. Many of our hominid ancestors roamed across the land. It is ultimately the homeland of every human being spread across the planet. Additionally, East Africa was the region that birthed one of the mightiest African civilizations, the Aksum Kingdom. At its height in the 3rd century, some ancient writers deemed it one of the four great powers of the world, alongside Rome, Persia, and China. Thanks to its position, it was part of the collective learning among Africa, Europe, and Asia. It rose to become one of the most complex civilizations of ancient Africa. Located in the northern part of modern Ethiopia, it once covered much of the current-day country of Eritrea, as well as northern Ethiopia, Sudan, Yemen, and southern Saudi Arabia. When we think of any powerful ancient civilizations in Africa, only the civilization of Egypt comes to mind. Meanwhile, the Aksum civilization was one of the earliest established societies in Africa that had contact with both Europe and Asia. But little is actually known about it. Research shows that Aksum was a major naval and trading power from the 1st to 7th centuries AD. As a civilization, it had a profound impact upon the people of Egypt, southern Arabia, Europe, and Asia, all of whom were visitors to its shores and in some cases were residents. Aksum is an interesting example of a sub-Saharan civilization flourishing towards the end of the period of the great Mediterranean empires. It provides a link between the trading systems of the Mediterranean and the Asiatic world, and shows the extent of international commerce at that time. It holds the fascination of being a lost civilization, yet one that was African, Christian, had its own script, coinage, and even an international reputation. It was an advanced civilization that surpassed the development of ancient Europe. It has been said that its knowledge was more extensive than that of Europeans in the 15th century. So it was 800 years further along. The kingdom built lasting stone monuments and achieved a number of firsts. It was the first African state to mint its own coinage and the first to officially adopt Christianity. Aksum even created Africa's only indigenous written script, Ge'ez, which is still in use in Ethiopia today. The transformation of East Africa in just 2,000 years from the cradle of humanity still foraging and using stone tools to a powerful ancient empire wielding blades of iron and ruling the seas is testament to the power of collective learning. Because of where they were located, they brought knowledge from all over the known world at that time. Mm-hmm. So, the capital city of Aksum likely formed around 400 BC. Legend has it that the kingdom was first established by the son of King Solomon of Israel and the Queen of Sheba. The kingdom began to rise in power and expand around the first century. Among the evidence for this rise to power is that Aksum was first mentioned by ancient Greco-Roman scholars around this time. It flourished from the 3rd to 6th century and then survived as a much smaller political entity. Aksum, the capital city, was a metropolis for its time, with a peak population as high as 20,000 people. Which, yes, sounds very small in today's standards, but at the time, that was a metropolis. The kingdom came to occupy a territory about 300 kilometers in length and 160 kilometers across, which is 4.8 million hectares. That's 5 times bigger than the island of Hawaii. It also, the original Death Star had a diameter of 160 kilometers, which is the width that the Aksum Kingdom was.
Wow, so it could blow up a planet.
The beginnings. The name Aksum may derive from a combination of two words from local languages, the Aju word for water and the Gies word for official. The water reference is probably due to the presence of large ancient rock cisterns in the area of the capital city. The name became even more appropriate as the kingdom grew to be such a powerful naval and trading power. Humans had inhabited the region and the valleys below since the Stone Age, and agrarian communities similar to those in Arabia had been there for at least a millennium. But the origins of the Kingdom of Aksum are mysterious. Scientists and historians are still trying to understand the process of cultural and economic development that led to the growth of a wide polity in this region. Nevertheless, it is clear that around the 1st century AD, Aksum had emerged as a state to unify the area. So, like a lot of places, people were living for long periods of time. We're not exactly sure how it turned from random people, like hunter-gatherers, even farmers. We're not sure how that made the step towards a group of organized people. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. Well, because there probably wasn't a lot of written stuff about how we went from here to here. It just happened, event sometime.
Yeah. For a long time, historians hypothesized that Aksum was founded by immigrants from Southwest Asia, who brought superior civilization along with them. However, archaeology reveals that the complex agrarian civilization of the area shows signs of developing many centuries before there were any such migrations. Investigations into East African history and the hunt for empirical evidence have since dispelled the long-standing myth that the African peoples were historically incapable of producing powerful agricultural states. This type of thinking
still happens?
Yeah, it just pisses me off so much because it's so racist. But unfortunately, it's also very common, especially the further back in history you look. Mm-hmm. I mean, sadly, it still happens today.
Yep.
For many years, Aksum was just a tiny settlement, slowly acquiring more land and wealth from trade. Then in 30 BC, something decisive happened. The Romans, under Augustus, conquered and annexed Egypt, which brought Aksum into contact with the Roman world and the Mediterranean. Aksum soon became a hub of overseas trade between the vast Roman Empire and the states of India. It grew as a prosperous connection for the transmission of trade goods and collective learning across the entire supercontinent of Afro-Eurasia. In the late 1st century, a single king replaced a confederation of chiefdoms and forged a united kingdom that would dominate the Ethiopian highlands for the next 6 centuries. The kingdom of Aksum, one of the greatest in the world at that time, was born. Aksum really hit its peak around 350 AD. It had already established some form of dominance over Yemen in southern Arabia, Somalia in southeast Africa, and several smaller tribes to the southwest. These subjugated tribes were left semi-autonomous, but had to pay tribute to Aksum, typically in the form of hundreds of heads of cattle. And this is indicated by Aksumite inscriptions. So they didn't take money from them or jewels, they took cattle. Yep. It is suggested that this system of semi-autonomy gave some justification to the Aksum rulers now calling themselves by the grand title Negusa Negast, which means King of Kings. Details of the Aksum government and how this absolute monarch controlled conquered tribes over the centuries are lacking, but the title King of Kings would suggest conquered rulers were permitted to continue to reign over their own peoples. The Aksum kingdom started using the name Ethiopia as early as the 4th century, although the name Aksum was still also used at that time.
Well, Aksum is actually a city now, isn't it?
It is a city, but the entire...
But the entire region.
Yeah.
It's like the Empire of Rome, but there is also... Or the Roman Empire.
Yes, but there's also the city of Rome. Rome. Yes, okay. Exactly. So how do we know about them? Well, despite its power and reputation, very little is known about Aksum. Written scripts existed, but no histories or descriptions have been found to make this African civilization come alive. Unlike the Rome, especially the Romans. They're the best example. But, right. I mean, Greeks, Egyptians, there's a lot more information about some of these.
Right.
Although, like I said, we've also covered ones with less information. Yes. And we will continue to do that. The ruins of the ancient city of Aksum are found close to Ethiopia's northern border. They mark the location of the heart of ancient Ethiopia. These massive ruins date from between the 1st and 13th century and include monolithic obelisks called stelae, royal tombs, and the ruins of ancient churches and castles. A series of inscriptions on stone tablets have proved to be of immense importance to historians of the ancient world. Some of them include trilingual texts with Greek, Sabaean, and Ge'ez on them. And Sabaean was a language used in the area before the creation of the native Ge'ez language.
Oh, it's Ge'ez, not Ye'ez. Like G-E-E-Z?
Yeah, okay. G-E apostrophe E-Z. Okay.
I thought at first it was Ye'ez.
Like no, it's G's.
I'm going to Ye'ez this word at you.
No, it's a G's.
Okay.
Like G's.
Yeah, now I get it. Now I know why people say that to me.
Now, we don't have a lot of general information about the society, as I've explained, but here is what we do know. Like many civilizations, Aksum society was hierarchical, with a king at the top, then nobles, and the general population below. Although it is unclear whether they had slaves, it is very likely, especially since they did part of their trade was in humans.
Mm-hmm.
In some descriptions, the ruler is described as King of Kings, and that's how we know that term, because of written descriptions. And that might suggest that there were other junior kings. So maybe the people of the other tribes were called junior kings. Maybe they kept their original title. It's really unknown. Like I said, it's a lot of educated guesses for some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
There is evidence of at least 10 to 12 small towns in the kingdom, which suggests it was an urban society. Aside from brief descriptions of these, there is only archaeological evidence, which can be difficult to interpret since the area has been continually inhabited. Little or nothing is known about such things as the role of women and family life. we may have kind of took for granted how much is known about Rome and how I could describe, but this is more typical. And this is why a lot of people know, and you can study ancient Rome and Greece and Egypt in such detail in university and stuff. But places like this, like smaller civilizations, aren't covered as much because we really just don't have the information on them. Mm-hmm. Although Axum had writing, very little has been found out about the society from inscriptions. It can be assumed that priests were important, and probably traders too, because of the money they would have made. Most of the poor were probably craftsmen or farmers. Wheat, barley, millet, and teff had been grown with success in the region at least as early as the first millennium BC. While cattle herding dates back to the second millennium BC, goats and sheep were also herded, and an added advantage for everyone was the absence of tropical parasitic diseases that blighted other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And I couldn't find anywhere that said how we know that or why that was the case, so sorry. To further increase their food production, they developed terraced farming and irrigation, which allowed them to farm the slopes of the local mountains. They prospered greatly from exporting their excess food to inland Africa. Now, the city of Axum was a well-organized center where education flourished, and the Axumites had extensive knowledge of mathematics and astronomy. The empire minted its own coins from copper, silver, and gold, and the coins were initially decorated with a new moon and two stars, but this changed to featuring the image of a cross after the adoption of Christianity. Coins were also multicultural, with the language used likely indicating the intended use. Gold coins were minted with Greek mottos for international use, because as we talked about in the Roman podcast,
Greek was more widely used.
Yeah, Greek, because the Greeks took over conquered much of the area before the Romans, more people knew Greek. Brass coins were struck with G's inscriptions for local use. As I said, Axum reached its peak around 325 AD. This was under the leadership of King Izana. During this time, Axum expanded its territory and became a major trade center. It was under this king that Axum converted to Christianity. The king was a devout Christian, and Christianity became the major religion of the entire kingdom. The area which Axum would later occupy originally used an Arabian-like script from the 5th century BC called Sabaean. So I briefly mentioned that Sabaean was a language that was used in the area prior to the adoption of G's.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it continued being used, but it was used from about the 5th century BC, and it was a Semitic language then used in southern Arabia as well.
Hmm.
Greek was also used in some inscriptions, like the trilingual ones.
Mm-hmm.
The earliest examples of the Axumites' own language of G's are found on rock slabs which date to the 2nd century AD. This script is also called Ethiopic, or Ethiopic, I'm not sure, resembles Sabaean, but had gradually evolved into quite a distinct script, which includes characters for vowels and consonants, and which was read from left to right. The G's script is still used today in modern Ethiopia. No large-scale statues have been discovered from the kingdom, but there are stone bases. One example has indentations for feet carved into it, with each foot space measuring 90 centimeters, or about 36 inches, which would make the standing figure three times life size. An inscription on the base indicates that there once stood a large metal figure on it, probably of a divinity. The same inscription mentions other statues of gold and bronze. The stone thrones found near Stele may also have seated metal statues on them. Small-scale figurines abound, and these depict nude females and animals. Unfortunately, the impressive stone chamber tombs of the kingdom were all looted in antiquity, and only broken fragments of these precious materials and pieces of storage chests and boxes indicate what has been lost to history. So that's one problem with a lot of the ancient areas that have been continually occupied, is they've been looted. Mm. With the exception of Egypt and Meroe, Aksum was the only ancient African state with written records. Inscriptions were frequently multilingual, testifying to the cosmopolitan nature of Aksumite communications. With wealth to hire swords and ships, and no comparable power in East Africa to oppose them, the Aksum Empire was one of the true powers of the ancient world. So they didn't have to have a big army themselves, like many of the other powers. They just hired others. Right. They had the extra money. As a hub of trade in the ancient world, Aksum was also a frequent witness to the technological developments transmitted across Africa, Europe, and Asia. Okay, now I'm going to talk just a little bit about their influence, travel, and trade. Because of Aksum's location and role in international trading, the culture of Aksum became a blend of many cultures throughout the region. They were influenced by the Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, and Arabs. They were able to construct large merchant ships that sailed on many waters in different parts of the globe and created the most extensive trade network of the ancient world. Their trading partners included most of the major states in the known world, and they were the principal supplier of African goods to the Roman Empire. Ooh. Which would be a big...
It's a big contract.
Yeah, exactly. Their knowledge of geography and navigation allowed them to reach Tanzania and seashells, where around the 2nd century, the natives built a blast furnace to smelt carbon steel, which was in great demand in many parts of the world. The Aksum fleet appeared off the coast of the Arabian Peninsula, Persia, China, India, Indonesia, and the Philippines. Coins have been found in many of these places, and it is speculated that the Aksumites may have even reached Australia, although there's no evidence to support this, only translated texts that describe the lands that they reached.
There's no evidence that says it didn't happen.
Yeah, but it's... there's texts that describe lands that they visited, mm-hmm. and people have...
taken it to think that it's Australia.
Yes, yes, exactly. Interpreted it.
There you go. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Gold and ivory were Aksum's main overseas exports. The Byzantines, or the Eastern Roman Empire in particular, could not get enough of both. But other goods included salt, slaves, live animals, tortoise shell, incense of frankincense and myrrh, rhino horns, obsidian, and emeralds. In exchange, they imported textiles, iron, steel, weapons, glassware, jewelry, spices, olive oil, and wine. Aksum tombs contain various items that confirm the presence of imported goods mentioned in historical texts. Some of these items are glass, jewelry, ivory, coins, sculpture, and pottery. Now, on to the beliefs. So this would be religion as well as the legends that are associated with this. So as I mentioned earlier, the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon are important figures in Ethiopian heritage. Traditional accounts describe their meeting that occurred when the Queen of Sheba traveled to Jerusalem. They obviously hit it off because their son was the first king of Ethiopia. King Menelik I formed the Solomonic dynasty, from which the rulers of Ethiopia up until the 1970s, so almost 2,000 years, or actually over 2,000, are said to be descended. So this is similar to Augustus claiming to be a descendant of Rome's founder, Romulus.
Right.
Only this lasted until the 1970s.
Right.
Legend has it that Axum is the home of the biblical Ark of the Covenant, which holds the tablets of law upon which the Ten Commandments are inscribed.
Wait, are you telling me that Indiana Jones found it in the wrong place?
Yes.
Damn it.
Menelik is said to have taken it on a visit to Jerusalem to see his father. So he stole it and brought it back to his kingdom.
Yep.
According to Ethiopian church tradition, the Ark of the Covenant is kept in one of the churches in the ancient city of Axum, the St. Mary of Zion Church, which was rebuilt in the 17th century, was built specifically to house the Ark. However, the shrine is guarded by a single monk guardian, and no one is allowed inside. Not even the rulers of Ethiopia or the heads of the Ethiopian church. Replicas of the Ark, called tabuts, are housed in all Ethiopian churches and are carried in procession on special days. So the Ark plays a very important role in their church. Yeah. Although traders and Egyptian missionaries had brought Christianity to the region early in the first millennium, it wasn't until the middle of the 4th century when King Izana converted to Christianity that it became the official religion of Axum. Axum was the second country in the world to adopt Christianity. The first was Armenia in 301, then the third was the Roman Empire in 392. So there wasn't a lot of space between them. It was all in the 4th century. Axum was a remarkably tolerant place, unlike a lot of the places.
Like everywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm. Especially for its time.
Yeah.
Followers of earlier African religions were not persecuted after the adoption of Christianity. In fact, archaeological excavations have uncovered ruins of Christian churches where both pagan and Christian artifacts have been found. In the 6th century, the first Muslims from the area of Mecca also found refuge in Axum. So there were multiple religions.
There was true freedom of religion there.
Yes.
That's nice.
By the 6th century, King Caleb was recognized as a Christian by the Emperor Justin I of Byzantium. Although Christianity had a profound effect upon Axum, Judaism also had a substantial impact on the kingdom. A group of people from the region called the Beta Israel have been described as Black Jews. Although their scriptures and prayers are in G's, rather than in Hebrew, they adhere to religious beliefs and practice set out by the Torah, the religious text of the Jewish religion. Although often regarded by scholars and academics as not technically Jewish, but instead a pre-Christian Semitic people, their religion shares a common ancestry with modern Judaism. So they had early Judaism, and they were the second country or civilization, I guess, empire, to introduce and accept Christianity in general. Prior to Christianity, the people of Axum had practiced an indigenous polytheistic religion which was prevalent on both sides of the Red Seas. Such gods, as well as ancestors, had sacrifices made in their honor, especially cattle, either living animals or votive representations of them. It is important to note, though, that the more ancient indigenous religious beliefs likely carried on for some time, as indicated by the careful wording of rulers' inscriptions, so as not to alienate that part of the population which did not accept Christianity. And that kind of shows how accepting they were.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to alienate anyone. So they even watched their words.
They were politically correct before politically correct
was a thing. Yeah, exactly. So what did the Axumites build and what kind of monuments did they have? The ruins of the ancient Axumite civilization cover a wide area in the Tigray Plateau. The most impressive monuments are definitely the monolithic obelisks, royal tombs, and the palace ruins dating to the 6th and 7th century. although the introduction of Christianity in the 4th century resulted in building a great many churches, most were continually used and rebuilt over time, so there aren't many, like, real ancient remains that can be seen today. Unlike their northern neighbors of Egypt, Aksum did not build pyramids of any kind. And Egypt built different types, mm-hmm, as well as mm-hmm. South America built types. Like, there's types of pyramids all over the world. Mm-hmm. Instead, Aksum is famous for building tall towers called stelae, which I have briefly mm-hmm. mentioned. The towers were elaborately carved with inscriptions, including some that were trilingual, bas-relief decorations, which are the when you carve out, but you carve the area around.
Instead of carving in to make a letter, you carve away where the letter isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, so you want it to stand out, like it pops out, instead of being carved into it. It's hard to explain, but...
No, I got it.
These stelae also often have stone doors and fake windows. They are utterly unique in the world, and many have survived to the present day. So some of them basically look like tall, like apartment building towers, but out of a single stone. It is believed that stelae marked graves or commemorated important events due to the rich decoration. They were constructed from a single fragment of nepheline syenite, which is a rock from the deep sea that was quarried about 4 kilometers from the city of Aksum. So they didn't have to bring them a long ways, but in that time it would have still been a lot of work. And they were stabilized by massive underground counterweights. The largest stelae found is about 33 meters high and weighs over 500 tons. Unfortunately, it lies in ruins and was probably damaged during construction. It was probably damaged while they were trying to stand it up. It is likely the tallest monolithic stone that ancient humans have ever attempted to erect. It far surpasses the other monolithics that we've discussed, such as Stonehenge and the Moai, by a lot. Stonehenge were roughly 4 meters, and the Moai, the tallest, was 10 meters. It even surpasses the Egyptian obelisks, with the tallest being 32 meters. So it's not a whole lot taller than that. It's at 33.
But still.
But
it's one more.
Yeah. Several stelae survive in the former city, now the town, of Aksum, that date between the 3rd and 4th century. The largest standing obelisk rises to a height of over 23 meters. So that's still standing. Mm-hmm. The other thing about these is you gotta think, that's 23 meters above ground. They were counterbalanced with a large portion of it underground. Mm-hmm. So that was a giant rock to move. Anyways, this stelae is exquisitely carved to represent a 9-story building of the Aksumites. It stands at the entrance of the main stelae area. Nearly 120 stelae are located in this stelae park within the city of Aksum, while an additional 600 rough-hewn stelae lie in a non-elite necropolis to the west. Their stone buildings used clay instead of mortar, with a decorative effect achieved by alternating projecting and recessed blocks. Wood was used between stone layers for horizontal support in the walls. For doorways, window frames, floors, roofs, and in ceiling corners to give extra structural support. The decoration on many buildings at Aksum and the motifs used in Aksumite art in general, such as the astral symbols of disc and crescent, are evidence of influence from southern Arabian cultures across the Red Sea. Although the influence may have been in the opposite direction. Maybe the Aksumites were influenced the Arabians. The capital city also has a dedicated area for craft workshops and, from the late 4th century onwards, many churches. Other remains of stone structures include 3 palace-like buildings which once had towers, each with stone-pillared basements royal tombs with massive walls, creating separate chambers, water cisterns, irrigation channels, and two- or three-story buildings used as residences by the Axum elite. Most large structures were built on a stepped granite base, composed of dressed blocks, with access provided by monumental staircases, usually consisting of 7 steps. Stone lionhead gargoyles often provided roof drainage. That's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Although not very accessible for someone like me.
No.
All those stairs would be quite the pain. Small buildings and courtyards surrounded a central pavilion, whose columned rooms were decorated with paintings. Punctuating the walls were granite doors and windows. Lower-class stone and mud dwellings, topped with thatched roofs, dotted the slopes around these palaces. Axum's capital showed signs of rapid growth. It was a loose collection of impressive buildings and burial grounds. The town grew so rapidly that there seems to have been no master plans for the city's layout, or the designation of city walls for where the city would stop growing. Axum built many grand monuments, and the wealthiest citizens were buried in elaborate tombs marked by the stelae. So it sounds like it was very similar to a lot of modern cities.
Yes.
Where we don't put any outskirts, we just keep growing and growing, sprawling.
Yeah. No walls to keep people out.
Or to keep construction within.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, a lot of ancient cities had walls. Which?
But the walls were put up to keep people out.
Yeah.
Or to keep the construction in.
Yeah. But one thing I do find kind of neat about this is that it sounds like most of the burials took place within the city.
Mm-hmm.
Which is completely opposite of Rome. Rome, it was illegal to be buried within the city limits. Mm-hmm. Even Augustus was buried out, like, his tomb was outside of the city at the time it was made. Like, it was illegal.
Hmm.
Which I didn't mention in our Rome series.
No, but you did not. I had no idea.
Hey, there's a lot to cover about Rome. You want me to do an entire episode on death related to...
I don't mind. And if you guys want to do it, you can also contact us. Let us know.
So, like many of the other topics we've covered, next will be the fall of this great empire, kingdom, civilization, whichever you want to cover, whichever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So there exists different hypotheses as to why the empire collapsed, but historians agree that climate changes must have greatly contributed to the end of the Axum kingdom. In the 6th century, the gradual decline of Axum began. Next, I'll discuss some of the possible causes, like we do for all these ancient civilizations. And just like in the past, you will notice a lot of similarities. History really does repeat itself. Although at least in ancient times, they didn't know what was going on around the world, right? Like, they didn't know that other people had fought, like other civilizations.
They didn't have a quick access to Google like we do.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't even know most of the world existed. they had more excuses for not learning from past mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the causes. First one is overuse of the land, which is one we have covered before.
Mm-hmm.
As Axum grew, it may have pushed its agricultural land too far, especially since we know the climate was changing. So the second one I'm going to mention is another one we've covered before, but this is a little different. It's outsiders and invaders. Axum had a little different in that the incursion of Western herders who formed themselves into small kingdoms grabbed parts of Axum territory for grazing their cattle, and they persistently attacked Axum's camel caravans, which likely added to strains on the Axum kingdom. They're getting attacked all the time. If their farmland's being taken over by cows, that would definitely cause problems.
Mm-hmm.
Axum did have typical invader issues as well, just like the other civilizations.
Was it the Gauls? The Goths?
No. The city of Adulis was destroyed by Islamic invaders mm-hmm. in 710. This isolated Axum and began its decline. Another cause? Wars.
It almost kind of ties into the last one, too.
Kind of, but this is them pushing outwards. So, the empire got into numerous wars with the Persians and various kingdoms of the Arabian Peninsula. Wars may have been Axum's swan song as a great power, with an overall weakening of Axumite authority and overexpenditure in money and manpower. Again, like many of the other kingdoms or cultures we've covered, internal turmoil. While the king and military were busy trying to gain territory through wars, the Axum elite were embroiled with infighting, which further weakened the state. Then there was the lack of state administration. The policy of Axum's kings to allow conquered tribal chiefs a good deal of autonomy often backfired and permitted some of them to have the means to launch rebellions. That's something we've also saw, especially with Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Near the end, they had a lot of problems with that. From the early 7th century onward, there was stiff competition for the Red Sea trade networks from Arab Muslims. So this trading power was now facing competition. As international profits from the exchange network declined, Axum lost its ability to control its own raw material sources, and that network collapsed. I also briefly mentioned climate change. Agricultural production collapsed due to rising temperature and excessive humidity caused by constant rainfall. And some tombs show evidence that flooding had become a major problem in the 4th century. So you had climate change already abusing the land and expanding the empire, and it's just a big mess.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another one we've covered a lot, religion. Changing religions likely contributed to the toppling of other great empires, like the Romans. But in the case of Axum, it was their refusal to change that hurt them. With the spread of Islam, Axum was cut off not only from the trade routes that connected the Mediterranean Sea with the Indian Ocean, but also from the rest of the Christian world, which was growing considerably at this time. This is when Christianity was at a rise over an Eastern Roman Empire or Byzantine, but Axum was cut off from them geographically. Another possibility is that plague contributed to the downfall. It's possible that Ethiopia was affected by the plague of Justinian,
which you did mention in the last episode, the Roman Empire.
Because it was a disease thought to be the first recorded instance of bubonic plague. And for the Roman emperors, it's likely that one of them died from the plague, if you remember that episode. Whether the fall was due to climate, wars, competition trading, plague, or any number of other factors, we just don't know. What we do know is that around the 7th century, Axum stopped producing coins, and the population was forced to go further inland to the highlands, abandoning the city of Axum as the capital. Arab writers of the time continued to describe Ethiopia as an extensive and powerful state, although it had lost control of most of the coast and its tributaries, and the writers no longer referred to it as Axum, they referred to it as Ethiopia. While land was lost in the north, it was gained in the south, and Ethiopia still attracted Arab merchants. The capital was moved to a new location, although its whereabouts are unknown even today. Unlike a lot of other civilizations that just kind of tapered off and disappeared, Axum continued to struggle after moving the capital, but did manage to survive, albeit as a much smaller territory.
Mm-hmm.
Local history holds that around 960, a Jewish queen named Judith defeated the empire and burned its churches and literature. While there is evidence of churches being burned and an invasion around this time, her existence has been questioned by some Western authors. And this burning could also explain the lack of information we have about.
Yep.
Just like with the Roman Kingdom.
The Library of Alexandria.
Exactly.
Lots of fires in Africa.
Yeah, there's so many stories about ancient history of knowledge being lost in fires due to fires. Another possibility is that the Axumite power was ended by a southern pagan queen. It is clear from contemporary sources that a female usurper did indeed rule the country at this time, and that her reign ended sometime before 1003 AD. Even after this, Axum limped along for another few centuries. Its glory days behind it, but its independence intact. All told, this East African agrarian civilization survived for nearly a millennium. Eventually, the remnants of the once great kingdom of Axum would rise again and form the great kingdom of Abyssinia in the 13th century. The city of Axum remained the coronation site of Ethiopian kings through the mid-19th century, and its architecture influenced later construction. So what remains of Axum today? The city of Axum, or town, still exists in northern Ethiopia. It is a fairly small city with a population of just over 50,000 people that live in a fairly constant state of poverty. It is one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in Africa and is a holy city of Ethiopian church. The ancient remains of the city of Axum was inscribed on the UNESCO World Heritage List in 1980 for its historical value.
And they didn't even have to dig a well to find it.
No, but a lot of it is covered by modern structures. Yeah. So. At the time of its inscription, it was noted that small, modern houses were built over most of the site, obscuring the majority of the underground Axumite structures. Some of them still remain covered by modern houses today. So the integrity of the property remains vulnerable. The city of Axum was also put under the jurisdiction and protection of the National Antiquities Authority in 1958, but there's no legal framework provided to protect the obelisks, except a general law, which also established the institution in charge of it. There's a lot of labels placed, but doesn't sound like anything can really be done.
They put up a lot of signs saying, don't walk on the grass.
Yeah. And now for my Simpsons reference. Now, I will admit, these are a bit of a stretch because there's no...
Some of mine are a stretch, too.
There is nowhere that Simpsons reference Axum. First, I'll refer to the season 6 episode, Homer the Great. Well, most people would know this episode because it is the Stonecutters episode. I think I even sang part of the song in one,
one episode. You have, I think in more than one episode.
Yeah. Who keeps Atlantis off the maps? Yeah. Anyways, in this episode, there is a reference to both Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant. So when Homer is dispelled from the Stonecutters, he has to leave behind all of the clothing that they gave him. And the underwear get dropped into a large chest that looks just like descriptions and pictures of the Ark of the Covenant. And the Indiana Jones references here is also that when dropped in this fire, you get what looks like ghostly spirits rise out of the flames. So that's a reference to the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark is also featured in The Simpsons Tapped Out game. There is a general reference to Ethiopia in season 23, The Food Wife. In this episode, the family car breaks down while driving through Little Ethiopia. Marge and the kids visit an Ethiopian restaurant and love the food so much, Bart says, "I wish I lived in Ethiopia." And they go on to become food bloggers because they absolutely love this food. In season 10, episode Simpsons Bible Stories, Homer dreams that he is King Solomon himself. And since religion played a large role in the Axum Kingdom, I have to mention that The Simpsons has a number of characters dedicated to various religions and bases a lot of episodes on spirituality. In fact, the show has been both praised and criticized by atheists, agnostics, liberals, conservatives, and religious people in general for its portrayal of faith and religion in society.
It's the show that brings everybody together.
Yeah, and I got that statement off of Wikipedia. It brings everyone together in that it pisses everyone off.
Mission accomplished.
In The Simpsons, Christianity is represented in its many forms, including Protestant, Catholic, Judaism, Orthodox, and even snake handling. I didn't realize snake handling was Christianity, but it's they believe that God will protect them. Yeah. Then there are characters and episodes dedicated to Hindu, Buddhism, Islam, Wicca, and even cults with non-specified belief systems. Just, I know that's a little bit of a stretch, but religion did play a big factor in Axum. And
yep.
That's all I have for now. What kind of pop culture references do you have?
Well,
aside from Indiana Jones.
Honestly, I didn't even add that one to start with because, well, it doesn't take place in Axum.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, there's Indiana Jones.
But hey,
there's the Lost Ark from 1981. Obviously.
But hey, I needed to stretch my Simpsons. It's difficult.
Yeah. There is an actual movie called Axum, but it's AXUM.
Yeah, it's spelled two different ways. Yeah,
and that came out in 2005.
Huh.
Yeah. There's a couple of big movies from the 90s. Well, I would say big movies, but big actresses who played the Queen of Sheba. Halle Berry in 1995 in Solomon and Sheba. Huh. And Vivica A. Fox in 1997 in the movie Solomon.
Wow, I never even heard of those movies.
Yeah, neither have I.
Oh, and you said about Axum is spelt. Axum is actually spelt all over different ways.
Yeah.
It's AXUM or AKSUM.
Yeah.
In fact, if you look through my notes, I even spell it different ways each time.
Well, the title of this episode is spelled the AKSUM.
Okay.
The Kingdom of Axum.
Okay.
So other movies, La Reine de Saba, obviously a French movie from 1913. The Queen of Sheba in 1921 and in 1952. King Solomon of Broadway in 1935. And another version of Solomon and Sheba from 1959. For television shows, in the television series American Gods, Bilquis was actually the legendary Queen of Sheba. She sought the wisdom of King Solomon, but the character is much more prominent in the show rather than in the book. So they actually expanded her character for the show rather than the book. And that ran from 2017 to 2021. Star Trek, the original series, I've used this reference before. Requiem for Methuselah in Season 3, Episode 21. Flint, the character who's the bad guy in that episode, he was King Solomon.
Okay.
Another TV show, Supernatural. They were never, King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba never actually appeared in the show, but they were mentioned a few times. King Solomon in season 1 and in season 13, and Queen of Sheba in season 11 and season 13. The season 13 episode was the Scorpion and the Frog, so they were both mentioned in that episode.
Okay.
Let's see, what else do we got here? We got...
Video games.
There's Roblox, Rise of Nations.
Roblox has...
Yeah, 2018. Civilization 6 in 2016.
Not surprising. 6 has a lot of them.
Yeah. Total War Attila. Axum was a playable faction in the Empire of Sand expansion pack.
Huh.
Yeah. And a couple of books. I've already mentioned The American Gods with the Queen of Sheba. But the Belisarius series by Eric Flint. Axumite Empire is a main ally of Byzantium. And that was a series that came out throughout 1998 to 2006. The Lion Hunters by Elizabeth Wien. It's an Arthurian / Axumite cycle. So it's in the books and they came out between 2003 and 2008.
So it's another one of those that link the King Arthur legend with another completely different civilization.
Yes.
Because there was that link in, was it for Rome as well?
Yeah. Because he was a Roman... officer.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what I got. I'm sure there's other movies with Solomon, but I didn't really go too much in because he wasn't in.
Yeah. He's part of the legend of the founding
like
of the
his
city.
His son.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a bit of a stretch, but sometimes, yeah.
At least the Queen of Sheba, she was the leader of that area.
Yeah.
She? Yeah. Yeah, that's
I'm impressed, actually, because doing the research for the kingdom itself was tricky. because they kept on saying over and over everywhere, there's not much known about it. So I probably said that way too many times during this episode, but the truth is, there's not a lot known about it.
Yeah. Yeah, if anyone has any questions or anything, you can contact us in several different ways. You can email us at diggingdeeperwiththeagents@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can contact us via Instagram or Facebook at Digging Deeper with the Ancients. Once again, all one word. Our Twitter is Digging Deep Pod.
And on Twitter, we sometimes come out with polls to try to determine what the next episode should be. We've done a couple of them so far. And so if you don't want to suggest a topic, but just want to give us your opinion about which of two, then that's an option for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much what we got for today. So, once again, like, share, subscribe, tell a friend about us. It's the way we grow and the way we'll keep the show going.
Maybe we can eventually get a sponsor. Hey, it's the goal.
I know.
Be nice to... But, of course, over in the Ukraine... The war is still going on, and we really appreciate the listener there, and we hope you stay safe.
Yeah, and really thanks everyone for listening. All right, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Bye.